Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economics think tank. I'm Jeroen Zettelmeyer, the director of Bruegel, and today we're going to speak about inflation and about the policy record of the European Central Bank. I'm glad to welcome our senior fellow, Zsolt Darvas. Hi, Zsolt.
Hello, Jeroen.
Thank you for joining us. Zsolt, so the European Central Bank has been under a lot of criticism recently, as have other major central banks, for letting inflation rise to levels that are really unprecedented since the 1970s. You have written a very nice blog post based on a more extensive analysis for the European Parliament, where you kind of dissect the ECB's record and tackle the question to what extent the ECB may have made mistakes or not. Maybe before you explain your findings, give us a little bit of background, some opening facts. So maybe talk a little bit about the blow-by-blow of what actually happened since inflation started becoming a topic of public debate last year, I guess, and how the ECB reacted to that.
I would start with the mid-2010s, when inflation in the euro area was persistently low. Since 2015, the European Central Bank started large-scale asset purchases with the aim of pushing inflation back to 2%. But before the pandemic, this was largely unsuccessful. I mean, the so-called core inflation, which is the indicator which does not include volatile energy and food prices, was practically stuck at 1%. And irrespective of the amount of assets the ECB purchased, like government bonds or various corporate securities, also the deposit rate was lowered to -0.5%, negative interest rate was applied. Simply, inflation didn't want to increase. Then came the pandemic, which had many devastating effects on human lives and also impacted inflation in various ways, namely that global trade was shocked for a couple of months. It was more difficult to obtain certain intermediate products into production. Also, for example, due to China's zero COVID policy, some parts of China was closed down. Chinese harbors were closed down. It was more difficult for shipping. Transportation costs increased. So there were a couple of bottlenecks, which, you know, when there is a shortage of something, the price of that good is going up. And we have already noticed already in late 2010, early 2020-21, that certain prices, including commodities, started to grow up. Now, at the same time, many governments and also central banks provided a lot of support for the economy during the pandemic. In the US, it was much stronger than in Europe. And in the United States also, private demand start to recover rather fast. And since there were, you know, lots of constraint on interactions, the demand was pushed towards goods away from services. And there was a large demand for goods in the US. I mean, prices there started to grow up. And since the US is the dominant economy of the world, it also had spillover effects in the rest of the world. And by early 2021, inflation already started to grow up in the United States. It was still very low in the euro area, but in the US it was going up. And by that time, people started to raise questions whether the big fiscal stimulus by initially the Trump presidency, then the Biden presidency was appropriate, and whether also the big monetary support by the Federal Reserve was appropriate because prices were starting to increase. But in the euro area still, at least in the first half of 2021, there was not really an inflation pressure. And, you know, also the mindset in Europe was that, you know, inflation is too low. It has been low for long. Measures should be implemented to raise inflation. And when we looked at forecasts made in 2021, basically nobody predicted that inflation in the euro area would increase to such a high level and will become as persistent as we see it from now. So today, you know, it's easy to say, oh, the ECB made a big mistake in 2021 by not starting monetary tightening earlier. But at that time, I think it was sensible, given that the long history of too low inflation and also the lots of uncertainties which surrounded the euro area and the global economy.
But in the end, you do find some lapses, as you call them, and we'll talk about those. You know, having said that, you know, the way that you introduced the topic, you made it seem that it looked rather obvious that inflation had to go up because you were telling a very persuasive story of why it went up, right? This combination of supply disruptions with quite a lot of fiscal and monetary support during the pandemic, which although there was less of it in Europe, there was some of it. So before we go into the substance of your piece, can you maybe restate why you think that some of the criticism that is levied at the ECB and maybe other central banks is unfair, and why maybe the case for tightening in 2021 was not that obvious? I mean, you said no one was forecasting it, but, you know, isn't it ECB's job to forecast it and to get it right? And, you know, from the way that you explained the logic of inflation pressures building up, it sounds like there was a very strong case for forecasting inflation going up. So what, if any, was the case into 2021 to not, say, start hitting on the brakes of monetary policy, you know, as early as, say, in the first quarter of 2021?
If we compare economic developments and labor market developments in the United States and in the euro area, we do see major differences. In the U.S., private consumption recovered by 2021, not just to the previous level of pre-pandemic level of consumption, but even to the pre-pandemic trend line, meaning that it was going up at the same pace along the same trend line as before the pandemic in the U.S. In Europe, there was also some recovery of private consumption, but much inferior, and even as of today, private consumption has not yet reached the pre-pandemic level. And of course, it's well below the pre-pandemic trend line. Another, I think, very telling difference is labor market. In the US, wages started to grow. In the euro area, this was hardly the case. Or if you look at, let's say, vacancies, I mean, in the US, there are many more vacancies than the number of unemployed people. In Europe, it's exactly the opposite. So there are a number of factors suggesting that, yes, some recovery started in the euro area, but it was not as strong as in the United States. And again, coming from, you know, the era of too low for too long, I think it also wanted to or pushed the ECB to err on the side of being more accommodative and to see indeed a sustained increase in inflation before actually start raising rates.
Okay, so if I understand you correctly then, your argument is that given the information that the European Central Bank had at the time, it was not necessarily wrong in waiting until late 2021 to start tightening monetary policy, but the main issue that you identify in your blog is that once it started, it was not forceful enough for reasons that we are going to get into. Is that, broadly speaking, the right characterization?
I mean, let me nuance it. In 2021, indeed, I think that not raising interest rates was the right decision. And we can also acknowledge that in 2021, at the December meeting, when inflation was by 5% by that time, the ECB started to announce a couple of measures, which was a kind of gradual withdrawal of the monetary stimulus the bank provided. But the big problem, in my view, was that in the December meeting, the ECB also provided a time-dependent condition on when interest rates will be going to be raised. Namely, the ECB said that interest rates will be raised only after net asset purchases will end. But at the same time, the ECB said that asset purchases will continue at least until October 2022, so October this year, which suggested that interest rates would be raised even beyond this date. Now, since inflation skyrocketed to 9%, this promise had to be broken. But in the period when ECB struggled to how to break this promise, it lost a couple of months and also might have lost credibility because, I mean, people saw, look, inflation is almost 10%. They get zero interest on their bank deposits. So the real value of their bank deposits is going down and the ECB doesn't do anything. So under such circumstances, the credibility of the central bank can be undermined. And this can have, you know, adverse impacts in later, because then the ECB need to prove that no, we are indeed caring for inflation, and they have to correct themselves, and such corrections can always be painful. And
right. Okay. So if I understand correctly, your point is when they finally start tightening, which is in late 2021, at a time when it was very clear that there was a danger that inflation would rise way above the target, they are to be blamed not necessarily for being very late, but in a sense, tightening in the wrong way. And if I understand it correctly, there are two elements to that. One, which you didn't emphasize in what you replied just now, but which I would like you to elaborate on, is that maybe in that initial tightening, in that initial meeting in December 21 itself, they were not forceful enough. They still emphasized monetary accommodation as being necessary. So maybe you can elaborate a bit on that point. The second point, which you started discussing, is that they announced some process for how they would continue tightening between December 21 and late 22, which followed something called forward guidance of central banks, where they tried to guide expectations. And this process, in effect, put them in a corset, right? It put restrictions on how quickly they could react to rising inflation. So you just started discussing that, but maybe you can say a bit more about the nature of that corset. And then there is a third very interesting point, which, you know, I'm not sure whether it's a separate point that you make in your blog, or it's, you know, just part of the story for why the initial tightening was not forceful enough, and also maybe for how it was done. Namely that, you know, they tightened with one instrument, but then offset this by loosening another instrument. And that might have had something to do with the ECB's fear that if they go overboard with the tightening, they would trigger a potential financial stability problem in the euro area, known as fragmentation. So there are these three points, right? The extent of the initial tightening, the nature of the forward guidance, and then the role of maybe objectives that are outside the objective of price stability, interfering with the price stability objective. So you have already talked about the second one a little bit, you know, feel free to complement, but I would like you to talk about the first and the third also.
So on your first point, the December 2021 meeting concluded that continued monetary accommodation is still needed. But, you know, when we read the monetary policy statements many, many times, we simply couldn't find a good justification for that. In fact, almost any justification for that. I mean, let me mention a few important points from this monetary policy statement. So the statement concluded that according to staff forecasts, GDP growth will rebound very strongly. And the forecast GDP growth for 2022, this year, was 4.2% real growth, which is quite large, and 2.9% for 2023. So about 4 or 3% growth annually, which is, you know, quite substantial. Then this ECB assessed financial conditions, which is available for people and also for companies. And they concluded the financial conditions are rather favorable. They also assessed risks, and the ECB's risk assessment concluded that the risks are balanced. So there was no major downside risk. I mean, nobody forecast the start of the Russian aggression against Ukraine last year. So also the risk assessment was broadly neutral. So in an environment when growth is projected to be very strong, risks are neutral, financial conditions are rather adequate, it was still unclear why further significant monetary accommodation was needed. Now, there was only just one factor, namely the inflation forecast of the ECB staff, which was a little bit below 2%. It was 1.8%.
This is the medium-term inflation forecast, right?
Yes. 1.8% both for 2022 and also for 2023. Oh,
I see.
You know, the target is 2%, so it was a little bit below that. But this was the only indication which suggested that some monetary policy accommodation would be needed. I mean, nevertheless, the gap was very, very small. And I mean, we know from the past that the ECB forecasts were not really, really reliable.
And you also suggest in your piece that had they included pressures on housing costs in that inflation index, they would have been above 2%, right?
Indeed, half a year before December meeting, so in July, the European Central Bank concluded a monetary strategy review. And if you look at the main pillars, I mean, they came out with 5 bullet points. And the second bullet point says that the so-called cost of owner-occupied housing, which is currently not included in the inflation indicator published by Eurostat, I mean, it's included, for example, in the indicator used in the United States, but not in the Eurozone. And the ECB proposed to include these housing costs in the consumption inflation indicator. And since housing costs are rising much more rapidly than average prices, had they included, for example, what they proposed half a year ago in their forecast, then they would have concluded that inflation is a target or even above target.
So basically there is this hesitancy to, in effect, call a situation where all the risks are really on one side, namely inflation going up too fast. And the question is, where does this hesitancy come from? It's not entirely clear, but certainly the fact that they were looking at a narrow inflation measure could have contributed to it. And that, in turn, is a bit strange because the ECB itself advocated broadening that inflation measure. So maybe here, just to jump to, in the order in which I spoke before, the last point, which is, do you think that the ECB's hesitancy to tighten could also have had something to do with this worry that the euro area consists of quite a heterogeneous group of countries, some with much higher debt levels than others, that rising interest rates might make it more difficult for some of these high debt countries to repay their debts, and that in turn would increase their borrowing costs in a way that complicates the life of the ECB, because it has to deal with, you know, different level of interest rates in different countries. So is this a possible motive for why the ECB decided to go slow, and also for how it decided to structure its tightening? And if so, is there anything the ECB could have done about it, or was this just a fact of life?
Likely, yes. If you read the monetary policy statement from December last year, it included a reference to renewed market fragmentation 3 times. It didn't explain what does that mean, but it's well understood that this indeed relates to the widening spread, let's say, between Italy and Germany. Mm-hmm. So fiscally more vulnerable countries and less vulnerable countries. And in fact, already the December meeting announced a small measure to tackle that, because the ECB, beyond purchasing new assets, it also renews. I mean, when an asset it purchased, let's say, a year ago expires, it tries to keep the stock of assets stable. So by renewing or buying new assets instead of the maturing asset has been done already before. And during this December meeting last year, the ECB emphasized that they will use these purchases under to compensate for the maturing assets very flexibly, also across countries and asset classes. And they said this in connection with this renewed fear from market fragmentation. But they also did another thing, which is I think, more critical.
More problematic.
More problematic indeed. Namely, the ECB had 2 major types of asset purchase programs. One which was started already in 2015, so 7 years ago, the standard asset purchase program, which had the aim of boosting inflation to reach 2%. During the pandemic, the ECB introduced a special pandemic emergency asset purchase program. And the goal of that was to support the economy during the difficult times of the pandemic. Now, ECB President Christine Lagarde stressed many, many times the 2 instruments are different. They have different goals. Nevertheless, what happened at this December meeting is that the ECB announced that from March, so on 3 months after the meeting, they will stop the pandemic asset purchases. But at the same time, they will double the purchases under the regular asset purchase program. And again, this is even more puzzling than, you know, not starting a more significant tightening earlier. You know, why boosting the regular asset purchase program at a time when the economic outlook is rosy, the inflation is already high. I mean, the actual inflation was 5%. The forecast was very close to 2% without on housing costs. So at that time, there was a need for doubling the asset purchases under the regular asset purchase program, which had the aim of lifting inflation up. And again, I mean, we don't know, but we can't exclude the possibility, what you just mentioned, that namely the fears from widening spreads between the borrowing cost of Eurozone governments was the underlying cause for this change.
Right.
And what the ECB could have done differently, let me also quickly respond to that. Actually, in July this year, so more than half a year later, the ECB introduced a so-called transmission protection instrument, which indeed has the target of controlling a spread whenever this is judged to be unreasonably large. Now, the ECB could have done that before and, you know, not raising in December the normal asset purchase program when inflation was already high and the forecast was very close to 2%.
Right. So the thinking is that, in a sense, the lack of a dedicated, powerful instrument that would address fragmentation may have, in a way, polluted a little bit the ECB's actions in the way it uses its regular asset purchase programs, which are not really designed to prevent spreads from specific member states running out of control, but they are generic monetary policy instruments, right? So had the ECB taken a stronger step in introducing a new instrument to address specifically that problem, the so-called fragmentation problem, it might have had a freer hand to then tighten monetary policy. And of course, we can only speculate why this was not done already in December, but clearly, you know, my view on this is that politically it was a lot easier to do this in July, particularly in the wake of another very big shock for Europe, the invasion of Ukraine with its consequences for inflation. That was, you know, clearly not the fault of member states that were potentially the victims of this fragmentation, right? So maybe this is one case where just sort of the economically optimal was not feasible at the time. But, you know, with hindsight, it is regrettable that this was not done earlier. Maybe just to go back to what I think is your main point in your blog, which is this use or improper use, not to put words in your mouth, but I think you do criticize this, of so-called forward guidance. So you briefly went through this, but just since this is the sort of the most technical part for our listeners, can you just go through that argument? So the ECB not only took certain actions, but it gave forward guidance to the market in December 2021 on when it would tighten and in what form it would tighten. So can you just repeat what it ended up doing and why this ended up being a problem?
We can talk about two types of tightening. One is the pace of net asset purchases, when it will go to zero, and later when it will actually, the ECB start to get rid of the assets it's purchased. And the second is about when to raise the interest rate, which was, the deposit rate was -0.5% in December, and up to July this year it was negative at -0.5%, even though inflation was already 9% by July. On asset purchases, the ECB provided that we call a date-dependent forward guidance. Namely, it specified what amount it will purchase, the new net asset purchases will be throughout 2022, including the amounts from October 2022, again suggesting that the net asset purchases will continue beyond October 2022. At the same time, the ECB also said that it will start increasing interest rates only after net asset purchases will end. And since the ECB said that asset purchases will continue beyond October this year, this implied that interest rates will be increased even later. And it was, you know, a kind of date-dependent forward guidance. And I mean, now we know that it had to be broken. But at the same time, the ECB also gave another forward guidance on interest rate increase, which in itself consisted of two conditions. One is that in the medium term, inflation has to converge to target, which is difficult to interpret, but most likely means that the staff forecast will has to be close to 2% in the medium term. And secondly, core inflation, so the underlying inflation, which doesn't include energy and food prices, has to increase substantially or durably. Now, by December, you know, the core inflation condition was met, in my view, because by that time, core inflation was 2.6%, so well above 2, and the trajectory showed that it was going up rapidly. So I think the core inflation criterion was already met.
Already in the December?
Already in December.
Mm-hmm. Long before they started raising interest.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Now, on the staff forecast, as I said, it was 1.8, which was a little bit below 2%, and even without considering the housing costs. So whether that condition was met or not, I mean, it could be more subjective, but it was in any case very close. So already in December, the conditions for the interest rate rise, on the one hand,
they were mixed, basically.
They were mixed. Some conditions were met, but at the same time, you know, there was this time-dependent condition that, you know, it will be raised only after the net asset purchases will end, which will happen only after October this year. Now, since in the meantime, inflation went up to 9%, I mean, it was simply unsustainable that the ECB right. keeps this promise. And
so when in your view were the data-driven conditions for interest rises satisfied? So not yet in December, but when roughly would the ECB have raised rates if it had worried only about its data-driven conditions?
I think in December last year, it was already quite close to that.
Okay, so in early 2022.
But let me mention that, you know, 6 weeks later, in February this year,
yes,
basically the decision was just that we maintain all the decisions which were made in December. So by, you know, early February, which was still before the war started, by then inflation went even further up a bit. All the promises which were made under the forward guidance in December were maintained equally without any change.
So they could have changed the forward guidance too.
Yes, they could have changed already in the February meeting the forward guidance. They decided not to do that. Now, then came the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which created lots of uncertainties. So at that time, I can understand that, you know, when a war starts in our country neighboring the European Union and results in many unexpected and lots of uncertainties, unexpected developments and the emergence of lots of uncertainties. So at that time, I could well understand that the ECB was a bit more hesitant to do anything, to see indeed what will be the outcome of sure. this war. Will it be a lasting war, not? What kind of impact it will have on energy prices and so on. But I think in February, it should have already changed before right. the war, the course. And also after that, it took quite some time until July, when the first interest rate increase actually.
Got it. Right. So if I understand you correctly, the original sin, if you like, was this mixing of data dependent, which is good, and date dependent forward guidance. And the latter de facto commits the ECB not to raise interest rates until October 2022, which then, you know, as this terrible inflation data comes pouring in, turns out to be much too late. So at that point, the ECB faces this very difficult choice, which is they either have to break the forward guidance, which would presumably then make any future attempt to give forward guidance to the markets less credible, or they stick to their forward guidance and tighten too late. And in effect, what they chose was the latter. And that's what you criticize them for. I mean, you criticize them, I guess, for having this inconsistent forward guidance in the first place, right? That is yes. the main criticism. Yes. But then on top of that, you're saying, you know, when we have such massive discrepancies between the two portions of the forward guidance, maybe the ECB would have been justified in throwing away the forward guidance at an earlier stage, right? Given the sort of exceptional risks of high inflation. Okay, so this brings me to sort of my last or maybe penultimate question, which is we are now in a situation where inflation is very, very high. It's really extraordinarily high, higher than anyone would have anticipated a year ago, you know, in the 10% range. And at the same time, we are clearly outside the time period where forward guidance would bind the ECB to do anything, right? It did in the end violate its forward guidance just a little bit, right, by raising inflation by 0.75 points in September, which is sort of earlier than markets would have expected based on what it stated in December of last year. So now with inflation so high and with the ECB in a way freed from its corset, is there a very clear case to really, really step on the monetary policy brakes and really raise interest rates much more quickly now or maybe not? Because, you know, the surprising thing to some of your blog is that your criticism that the ECB was too timid in raising rates in most of 2022 does not necessarily seem to translate to a strong recommendation to sort of go all out on raising rates now. So maybe can you explain why you take that view?
Yes, in our longer paper that we wrote together with Katarina Martins for the European Parliament, we analyzed various economic and financial indicators, and we concluded that in the Eurozone, the current high inflation is to a very large extent driven by high energy prices. Also, demand is recovering, but not as strongly as in the US. There are also lots of, as we discussed earlier, supply side bottlenecks, like certain parts and components are simply not accessible for the industry. It's more difficult shipping and so on. But still, the dominant driver of current inflation is high energy prices. But high inflation also has the impact that since wage growth has not accelerated, that it means that, you know, the real value of the income that people get is going down. So if inflation is 10%, wages grow by 2-3%, it means that, you know, people can buy 7-8% less goods and services from their income. And sooner or later, this will likely have an impact on inflation. So if people can purchase less than they used to, then they will purchase less. And this will have, you know, a dampening impact on inflation from the demand side. On the other hand, you know, we still don't know what will happen to energy prices. We see lots of volatility. I mean, for example, the past few weeks, there has been a decline. Who knows what the next few weeks and months will bring. But in the absence of a very big new shock to energy prices, also the direct impact of energy prices on inflation will simply fade. So energy prices may remain high, but at least if there is no further increase, they won't increase inflation directly further. Now, this would mean that this is somehow sometimes called a kind of base effect in the jargon of statistics. So this would mean that if, you know, nothing really happens, inflation will likely decline, let's say in 1 year from now, even without further strong monetary tightening. And at the same time, you also have all the uncertainties related to the war in Ukraine. What negative impact it will have on the EU, whether Russian gas supply will completely stop during this winter or we will still get some Russian gas, how we will be able to substitute that. So there are lots of economic uncertainties. So all of these sectors, due to economic uncertainties and I would say a decline of inflation due to base effects, suggest that for me and for us with Katarina Martins, we suggested that there should be a more cautious approach. Now, I do think that interest rates will have to go up further because currently the ECB's deposit rate is 0.75%. If, let's say, the long-run inflation is 2, it still means that the interest rate is below the long-run inflation level of 2%, and it has to reach at least that and even somewhat higher value of that. So I think there is still a case for monetary tightening. But due to the lots of uncertainties and all of these base effects, our recommendation was to go slowly in the next few months. Let's see what the winter will bring, whether Europe will face a deep recession or just a mild slowdown. And, you know, if there is no big effect, then rate increases can accelerate. But if, you know, there is a big effect and a big slowdown, then maybe rate increases will need to be stopped for a year and can be continued only a year later.
Right. So this makes a lot of sense to me. So again, to recap, there are two reasons why you argue that raises, while they should occur, should be more slow. One is that, you know, two of the really fundamental drivers of inflation in the past, namely energy price increases and, you know, very strong demand conditions, are bound to go away So even if energy prices stay high, they will not continue increasing. And clearly, you know, the euro area economy is on track for a recession, which we hope will be mild, but there is going to be a major downturn. And at the same time, there's a lot of uncertainty. And so you argue for further increases because inflation is still so high, but you argue for taking them slowly. Now, there is one argument, however, that I want you to respond to, which is, you know, one of the premises of what you just said is this idea that wages have not yet responded to inflation pressures in a big way, which is part of the story for why demand may be coming down, right? Purchasing power is coming down. But clearly, you know, this is not something that can be taken for granted. So the proponents of faster rises argue that unless the ECB really takes a very tough stance and, you know, signals that it is under no circumstances willing to tolerate higher inflation by really going very, very quickly above this neutral inflation rate that you just mentioned, maybe wage setting will actually drive up inflation and we will get into this infamous wage price spiral. So that, you know, basically wage setters need a little bit of shock and awe from the ECB to persuade them not to go this route. Do you take this argument seriously?
Yes, and I do think that this was the reason why the ECB increased its interest rates by 75 basis points in September. Mm-hmm. Indeed, to demonstrate that, yes, we are very strong, we will fight inflation and we will not tolerate inflation in the medium term.
Right.
But having said that, due to the uncertainty of the economic impacts of the war and what will come this winter and what will come next year, still on balance, we think that still, I would say, a gradual approach, let's say in the next 3 months, would right. be more appropriate, because we can also recall, you know, what happened in 2012.
Yes.
When that time the ECB raised interest rate twice in the first half of the year and already in the second half of the year, in the same year, they had to cut because right. the economic conditions deteriorated.
Right.
And we also faced the risk of that happening. So I would suggest a gradual approach, let's say, until spring next year. We will see how the economy responded. And, you know, if there is no big recession, then yes, the high rate increases can continue.
This certainly is persuasive to me. Now, maybe just the last point, we're basically out of time. In your piece, you suggest a new instrument, ECB instrument, to address energy bottlenecks. This sounds like one of these crazy ideas for the ECB to overstep its boundaries. So can you maybe explain why this is not so crazy? And what do you mean by an ECB instrument to address energy bottlenecks?
The green transition is the only solution for getting rid of Russian fossil fuels fast. Mm-hmm. And we know that currently high energy prices are the major drivers of current inflation. And this might happen in the years to come as well. Now, if the ECB raises interest rates, it will do to discourage consumption and investment. I mean, that's basic economics. And it will also thereby discourage investment in, let's say, house insulation, which would reduce energy consumption, and clean energy generation, which would help to replace fossil fuels with clean energy. So the rate increase will discourage all those investments, which can act to counterbalance, you know, high energy prices. So if there is a way falling within the mandate of the ECB not to discourage those kinds of investments which can ease energy bottlenecks, you know, that I think can be well within the mandate and can be helpful. So that's why we propose a very specific, we called energy long-term refinancing operation, which would basically apply to lending by banks at favorable terms on two specific issues. One is reducing energy consumption, like I just said, house insulation. So if households want to insulate their houses, they could get, you know, a very cheap loan for that. And the second is clean energy generation. Now, this differs, for example, some other people suggested a more broader so-called green long-term refinancing operations. Our approach is narrower because there are also many aspects of the green transition which are absolutely important for the climate, but doesn't have a direct relevance for inflation. For example, waste management. If we throw all the plastic bottles around, you know, and we pollute everything. I mean, this would have horrible environmental consequences, but that wouldn't have a direct impact on inflation. So we only proposed the ECB to offer a special lending facility which can reduce the energy price component of inflation.
So it may sound a bit unconventional, but it's actually quite closely tied to the mandate. And I think we may have to stop it here, Jolt. Thank you so much. And
thank you.
Thank you to our listeners for tuning in to The Sound of Economics. You can read the blog post we just discussed, Tackling Inflation, Learning from the European Central Bank's Six Lapses, as well as other analysis by our scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. Thanks a lot for joining in, and until next time, bye-bye.